Now, the next subheading of this chapter is Definition of Criticism, Function of Criticism, Qualifications of a Critic, Method of Criticism. It is in his essay on the function of criticism at the present time, prefixed to the first series of his essays in criticism, that Arnold defines criticism, elaborates its functions, and also lays down the essential of a component critic. His view of criticism must be assessed in the context of the degenerate and chaotic state of contemporary criticism. He found cultural anarchy everywhere, and his avowed mission was to bring about cultural regeneration. Next subheading, the importance of the critic and criticism definition. In the very beginning of the essay, Arnold admits that the critical faculty is lower than the creative one, but it is critical activity which makes creation possible. Successful creation requires a current of best and noble ideas, but such a current is not always available, and in such uncongenial times, creative activity suffers. Thus, Gray, who had the soul of a poet, happened to be born in uncongenial times, and so his poetic production is meager and scant. Arnold agrees with Taine that for successful creation, both the power of the man and the power of the moment must conquer, and the power of the moment, that is, stir and growth of noble ideas, is made possible by criticism. Criticism is not merely judgment in literature. Its function is much more noble, exalted, and catholic. Then, next para, Arnold defines criticism as a disinterested endeavor to learn and propagate the best that is known and thought in the world, and thus to establish a current of fresh and true ideas. Thus, the task of the critic is threefold in character. First, there is critic's duty to learn and understand. He must see things as they really are. Thus equipped, his second task is to hand on his idea to others, to convert the world, to make the best ideas prevail. His work in this respect is that of a missionary. But thirdly, he is also preparing an atmosphere favorable for the creative genius of the future by promoting a current of ideas in the highest degree, animating and neurizing to the creative power, says R.A. Scott James. The function of Arnold's critic in the broadest sense of the term is to promote culture. His function as literary critic is to promote that part of the culture which depends upon knowledge of letters. The critic is as much concerned with making the truth prevail as in seeing and learning it. He aims at getting acceptance for his ideas, in carrying others along with him in his march towards perfection. Thus, there is an element of the propagandist in Arnold's conception of the role of the critic and criticism. That is why he has been criticized as a salesman. The critic must propagate noble ideas, he must repeatedly stress them, for only then he can make them prevail. It is only in his way that culture can be promoted. It is only in this way that a current of noble ideas can be established and successful creation made possible. Then the next heading, the critic, his disinterestedness. Further, Arnold's use of the word disinterested has been the subject of much hot controversy. What does he exactly mean by saying that the critic must be disinterested? Says R.A. Scott James, the interests from which he would have us be free are those which militate against intellectual and moral perfection. Our judgment, he tells us, should never be swayed by the prejudice of the barbarian, the aristocrat who has spirit and politeness, but is a little inaccessible to ideas and light. Still less must it be swayed by the blind impulses of the populace, which Arnold chooses to speak of in terms of bawling, hustling, smashing, and beer. Most of all shall it shun that classification of ideas which marks the Philistines, the complacent middle classes who like fanaticism, business, money-making, deputations, comfort, tea meetings. Culture will always work to disentangle itself from untruths and half-truths, from values which are attached to the machinery of life rather than the spiritual life which machinery should subserve. It will distinguish means from end, and the end it will set before itself is that of perfection, spiritual growth governed by sweetness and light. It must shun provincialism, which may take the forms of excess, ignorance, or bathos, and endeavor to be in contact with the mainstream of human life. The critic must be disinterested in the sense that he should pursue only the ends of cultural perfection and should remain uninfluenced by the coarser appeals of the Philistine. In analyzing the pernicious influences which beset the critic, Arnold has made a great advance and has rendered a service to criticism. He has put before him for his guidance a majestic ideal of intellectual and spiritual excellence in accord with the best that has been known and thought in the world. But let us frankly face his position. He has urged that the critic should be free from ignoble interests, but in doing so he has asked for his subjection to certain other interests which may be the more subtly beguiling because they are noble. He has emancipated him from certain intellectually unworthy interests only to bind him all the more tightly to spiritual interests determined, however sweetly and reasonably, by the moral and social passion for doing good. Disinterestedness implies that the critic or the artist must be concerned with nothing else but his subject matter. But Arnold ties the critic to preconceived notions of moral perfection which are likely to color his judgment and make him overpraise some and be unfair to others. In this way, does the apostle of moral perfection become the prophet of moral perfection? James Scott. He frees the critic from certain interests, ulterior political, practical considerations, but he ties him up to other interests. Then the next subheading is Function of Criticism, Arnold's Exalted Conception. Arnold has a high conception of the vocation of a critic and the function of criticism. The critic is himself cultured. He knows the bent that has been thought and known. He helps others to become cultured, and he also makes literary activity possible by establishing a current of novel ideas when such a current is wanting. R.A. Scott James criticizes Arnold for overemphasizing the majesty of his own calling. For Arnold, it is the critic who discovers the ideas, he who propagates them, and nothing remains for the literary genius but to walk in and undertake the great work of synthesis and exposition. No doubt, the powerful critic plays his part in fertilizing the soil and in watering the young plant. And if it be true, as I have suggested, that the critic himself is an artist whose chosen subject matter lies in the life of literature, then he, too, must play his part in the tossing and fro of ideas between artist and artist. But Arnold has advanced no reason for believing that he is more than one of the many voices which fill the air and set the echoes ringing, stirring the creative impulse of the potential poets in our midst. This art impulse does not necessarily spring from formally correct ideas. It is started by notions of any and every kind hurtling from side to side. It is not released only by the force of culture, though culture will keep it in the straight and narrow path. The critic performs another important function as well. He rouses men out of their self-satisfaction and complacency, for such complacency is vulgarizing and retarding. By shaking the complacency of men, he makes their mind dwell upon what is excellent in itself and the absolute beauty and fitness of things. He raises them above practical consideration by making them contemplate and ideally perfect. Practical considerations are vulgarizing. They make men incapable of perceiving fine distinctions. Arnold refers to such incapacity as Philistinism, and it is criticism in the true sense of the word that can save us from it. The critic must rise above practical considerations, for such considerations improvise the soul. He must always have ideal perfection as his aim, for it is only then that he can make others rise to it. Indeed, Arnold makes too exacting a demand on the critic. He must know the best that is known and thought in the world, and not merely in his own country or in one or two countries. And he must know the best not in literature alone, but in other subjects as well. He must be a man of stupendous knowledge and understanding, one who rises above personal considerations and with missionary zeal tries to make the best ideas prevail. It is only through such catholicity of reading that the critic can combat the sins of parochialism and provincialism. Then again, he must have tact enough to see things as they are in themselves and to apply to life the noble ideas he has discovered. The next subheading is False Standards of Judgment, Personal and Historical. But then, how is the critic to find out? How is he to discover what is the best and the noblest, and how is he to perform his mission? First, as already pointed out above, he must have tact, which is unfailing guide to the excellent. Secondly, he must free himself from certain false standards of judgments which come in the way of a real estimate. Such false standards are the personal and the historical. By the former, he means an intrusion of the critic's own likes and dislikes in his judgment of literature. Our personal affinities, likings, and circumstances, he says, have great power to sway our estimate of this or that poet's work and to make us attach more importance to it as poetry than in itself it really possesses. A real estimate of poetry rises above personal predilections and prejudices. Personal estimates result in the hysterical, eruptive, and aggressive manner in literature. The historic estimate is equally fallacious and misleading. A poem may be valuable historically, but it may not be of much value as it is in itself. He writes, "The courage of development of a nation's language, thought, and poetry is profoundly interesting, and by regarding a poet's work as a stage in this course of development, we may easily bring ourselves to make it of more importance as poetry than in itself it really is. We may come to use a language of quite exaggerated praise in criticizing it, in short, to overrate it. So arises in our poetic judgments the fallacy caused by the estimate which we may call the poet, a knowledge of his character and circumstances, as well as of his social milieu, is essential for correct understanding." The next subheading is the right method, the touchstone. In order to guide the critic in the performance of his task, he prescribes his well-known touchstone method. Arnold points out that it is useless to lay down for the purpose abstract characteristics of the high quality of a poem. It is much better simply to have recourse to concrete examples, to take specimens of poetry of the high, the very highest quality, and to say, "The characters of a high quality of poetry are what is expressed there." He bids us shun the false valuations of the historic estimate and the personal estimate and attain to a real estimate by learning to feel and enjoy the best work of the real classic and appreciate the wide difference between it and all lesser works. If we ask how we are to know this best when we see it, he answers that it is enough in general to acclaim it. It is there and there. But if that is not enough, he adds that the high qualities lie both in the matter and the substance of the poetry and in the manner and style, and these have a mark, an accent of high beauty, worth, and power. The substance and matter will possess in an eminent degree truth and seriousness, and this character is inseparable from the superiority of diction and movement, which marks the style and manner. He says, "There can be no more useful help for discovering what poetry belongs to the class of the truly excellent, and can, therefore, do us most good than to have always in one's mind lines and expressions of the great masters and to apply them as a touchstone to the other poetry." Of course, we are not to require this other poetry to resemble them. It may be very dissimilar, but if we have any fact, we shall find them. When we have lodged them well in our minds an infallible touchstone for detecting the presence or absence of high poetic quality and also degree of this quality in all other poetry which we may place beside them. Then, taking a few widely different passages from Homer, Dante, Shakespeare, and Milton, he points out how they all impress by their poetical quality, so they all belong to the class of the truly excellent. The touchstone method has obvious limitations. Lines, even passages, when taken out of context, are often misleading. However, the true worth of a work can be judged by its total expression and not by single lines or brief passages. Earlier, Arnold himself had stressed the value of the total impression. Here, he contradicts his own earlier pronouncements. But there is no reason why we should not extend his comparative method, not resting content with detached judgments from isolated passages, but comparing the whole impression we have in our mind of one work with the whole impression that has been stamped upon our minds by a masterpiece. The comparative method is an invaluable aid to appreciation in approaching any kind of art. This is just as true of fiction as of poetry, of painting as of literature, and it is helpful not merely thus to compare the masterpiece and the lesser work, but the good with the not so good, the sincere with the not quite sincere, and clever with the too clever by half. Arnold has provided us with an excellent example of how to use the comparative method, and he has enabled us to see that it may be fruitful in the highest degree when employed by a critic of exceptional tact. 7. This is point 7 and next subheading. Arnold's practical criticism, its worth and significance, its limitations. Illuminating and suggestive remarks on poets and poetry are scattered all over Arnold's literary criticism. However, the Essays in Criticism, first and second series, contain the best of his practical criticism. In the study of poetry, he makes a rapid critical survey of English poetry from Chaucer to the end of 18th century, in order to show that really great poetry is the criticism of life and that it has high seriousness. In the Function of Criticism, he applies the touchstone method to a number of poets, both ancient and modern. Besides, there are a number of essays on both English and foreign poets. Of these, the best are the essays on Gray, Keats, Shelley, and Wordsworth. We give below brief synopses of these essays to illustrate Arnold's critical methods and to bring out the merits and demerits of his practical criticism. Then point A on Thomas Gray. First point, Dr. Johnson did not like Gray, but there are other critics who have spoken very highly of him. In fact, Johnson was out of sympathy with him and did him great injustice. Second, the Elegy is a beautiful poem, but according to Arnold, it is not Gray's best work in poetry. It was popular because of its subject, which would have made it popular even if it were written in prose. Then, point third, Gray was perhaps the most learned man in Europe in his time. He had read not only many literatures, but also history, politics, philosophy, criticism, natural science, and books of travel and adventure. His qualities of soul were as high as his qualities of mind. His literary criticism is ample testimony to his powers of intellect. His letters and the love and affection of his friends for him amply bring out the greatness of his soul. Then point fifth. Gray had all the qualities and endowments which go to make a great poet. Still, his poetical production was scanty. This scantiness cannot be attributed to his melancholy and ill health. Other poets have suffered even more than Gray, but still their production is abundant. Point 6. Gray was born in an age whose task was to create a plain, clear, straightforward, efficient prose. In other words, Gray, a born poet, fell upon an age of prose. His full spiritual flowering was, under the circumstances, impossible. The unfavorable milieu accounts for the scantiness of his production, for his sterility. Point 7. Gray's poetry is not free from the faults of his age. Genuine poetry is conceived and composed in the soul, while the poetry of Dryden, Pope, and others of their school is conceived and composed in their wits. His poetry also is not always pure in diction or true in evolution. Then point 8. Still he is alone, or almost alone, in poetic merit in his age. He alone of his contemporaries reached the excellence in style which he aimed at. He may not rank with the great masters of the golden age of poetry, but he is certainly greater than his contemporaries. Then B. On Keats. First, Keats as a poet is abundantly and enchantingly sensuous. Nobody can question this. But he was wanting in character and self-control, which are necessary for a great poet. Second, his love letters show that he was passion's slave, entirely enervated and without, say, self-control or dignity. Keats' love letter is the love letter of a surgeon's apprentice. Third, Keats was, by his promise, if not fully by his performance, one of the greatest of English poets. But a merely sensuous man cannot, either by promise or by performance, be a very great poet. There must have been elements of high character and virtue in Keats. Fourth, Keats was the very soul of manliness and courage. He was a believer in the superiority of virtue above beauty. He tried to develop the manly qualities of his character, but his effort was frustrated by disease and short life. His letters bring out the strength and virtue of his character. Fifth, Keats' criticism of his own productions, of the public, and of the literary critics shows that Keats was a man of a strong character. He had flint and iron in him. He also brings out his strength and clearness of judgment. He was not a weakling avid for praises, one who could be snuffed out by an article. Sixth, Keats wanted to devote his faculties to ardors rather than the pleasures of song. He was determined to get knowledge through application, study, and thought. Seventh, Keats' yearning's passion for the beautiful was not a passion of the sensuous or the sentimental man. It was an intellectual and spiritual passion. That is why he could often write as bitterly and plainly to women at. Keats loved the principle of beauty in all things. He perceived the necessary relation of beauty with truth and of both with joy. This was no small achievement. Point 9. Misfortune, disease, and early death was responsible for Keats' partial and incomplete achievement. 10th. Keats, in spite of his premature death, ranked with Shakespeare by virtue of his faculty of natural magic. He had more than any other poet almost Shakespearean felicity of expression. Then 11. But Keats was not ripe for that faculty of moral interpretation which Shakespeare has. Then point 12. Keats is perfect in his shorter pieces because in them the faculty of moral interpretation and the high architectonics which go with complete poetic development are not required. Then point C on Wordsworth. Wordsworth was popular in his own lifetime, but since his death his popularity has gradually declined. Recognition was slow to come to him, and it has easily drawn away from him. He is not fully recognized at home. He is not at all recognized abroad. Then point 2. He is surprising for the poetical performance of Wordsworth, the most considerable in the English language, next only to that of Shakespeare and Milton, and in European poetry it is next only to Goethe and Moliere. Moliere. Point 3. But there are definite reasons for this lack of recognition. Wordsworth's best work is in his shorter pieces, many of which are of first-rate excellence. In order to appreciate his real greatness, it is necessary to disengage his best work from the large quantity of inferior work produced by him. He must be presented to the reading public in a suitable selection. Point 4. Wordsworth's superiority arises from the powerful application of ideas to life. He applies to his subject his ideas on man, on nature, and on human life. His best poems are criticism of life. His work has moral profundity, for he answers the question how to live. And this is a moral question. Wordsworth deals with life as a whole, and his treatment of life has high seriousness. Point 5. Wordsworth's formal philosophy, as revealed in The Excursion and in the Ode on Intimations of Immortality, is not an element in his poetic greatness. Indeed, too much talk about his philosophy has obscured his greatness as a poet. Then point 6. Wordsworth communicates to us the joy in widest commonality spread. It is for this reason that his poetry soothes, consoles, and strengthens. Point 7. Wordsworth's poetry, at its best, is as inevitable as nature herself. Often nature seems to take the pen out of his hand and write for him with her own bare, sheer, penetrating power. His use of the plain style has something unique and unmatchable. Sometimes he is bold, but it is boldness full of the grandeur. Point 8. Wordsworth's poetry is unique when there is a successful balance of profound truth of subject with profound truth of execution. There he ranks with the greatest. Point 9. Wordsworth's poetry is one of the chief glories of English poetry, and by nothing in England so glorious as by his poetry. Then point 10. His poetry at its best is sure to cooperate with benign tendencies in human nature and make men happier, wiser, and better. Then point D on Seeley. It was not desirable on the part of Professor Dowden to relate in full Seeley's private life, for there is much in it that is ridiculous and odious and ought not to have been brought to light. Second, Professor Dowden pleads for Seeley like an advocate. Such pleading is harmful to Seeley. Arnold gives us a brief outline of Seeley's life up to the time of his second marriage. Seeley married Harriet Westbrook and then, deserting her, eloped with Mary Wollstonecraft. Harriet committed suicide by drowning. Then point 4. Professor Dowden tries to defend Seeley's conduct towards Harriet, but Arnold strongly condemns him. Professor Dowden's championship of Seeley is unjust to a cruelly used and unhappy girl. Point 5. The fact is that Seeley had an inflammable nature. His opinions about people were constantly changing. There was an inhuman want of humor in him. He had at the same time a tremendous power of self-deception. Thus he deceived himself into thinking that Harriet was unfaithful to him and that he would easily get divorced. Then point 6. In spite of his faults, Seeley had qualities of character which make him angelic. A glance at the facts of his life is sufficient to prove this. 7. Seeley was the friend of the unfriended poor. He possessed feminine refinement and gracious manners. He was a perfect gentleman, entirely without arrogance or aggressive egotism. His earnestness, his perfect gentleness of breeding, and his freedom from everything artificial charmed everybody. Then point 8. Point number 8. Seeley's poetry too has great charm, and yet in poetry no less than in life, Seeley is a beautiful and infectual angel, beating in the void his luminous wings in vain. In other words, there is an incurable want of a sound subject matter in his poetry. As a result, it suffers from unsubstantiality. In life as well as in poetry, Seeley is a vision of beauty, availing nothing, effecting nothing. Then Arnold's practical criticism, its merits. Arnold's practical criticism does bring out his critical acumen and insight. For example, he says that Keats had natural magic of Shakespeare, but he lacked his power of architecture and could not create the total impression of Gray. He rightly says that he fails on uncongenial ease, and his accounts for a scantiness of his production. Similarly, he is very right in saying that to be popularly appreciated, Wordsworth must be presented through a suitable translation, and that the Wordsworthians, instead of stressing his philosophy, should stress his merits as a poet. Many of his remarks, says Sainsbury, are acute, sensitive, inspired, and inspiring. Arnold's practical criticism also brings out his genius for trenchant praising. Say Wimstead and Brooks, Arnold's mixed regard for the major English poets of the preceding generation produced some of the most highly colored images which he has left us. Seeley, a beautiful and ineffectual angel, beating in the void his luminous wings in vain. Byron, in the act of carrying across Europe the peasant of his bleeding heart. Coleridge, a poet and philosopher wrecked in a mist of opium. Keats' letters, the love letters of a surgeon's apprentice. Arnold's continental orientation is also clearly brought out. In the first series of his essay, it is the continental writers he selects for a study. The English poets have only a secondary place in his consideration. His methods of criticism are those of Santi, Bue and Tanny. He is quite aware of the importance of the man and the milieu. A writer's works are judged against the background of his life and character and his social environment. Then the next subheading is its limitations. Arnold's practical criticism suffers from a number of serious limitations. For one thing, he has not left behind him an analytical study of even a single poem. He has confined himself either to a critical survey of the course of English poetry or to general studies of particular poets. Secondly, his criticism is prejudiced by his classical and moral bias. His criticism of the classics, say of Homer, is more sympathetic than that of the modern poets. Thirdly, his dislike of the romantic poets is largely moral. It arises from his dislike of the man and not from an impartial appraisal of literary merit. Say Wimstatt and Brooks, his dislike of these poets was partly biographical, and to that extent it was purely moral. His dislike of Seeley, for example, results from the unpleasant aspects of his life recently revealed by Professor Dowden. Fourthly, he judges a poet on the basis of his preconceived theories and not with an open mind. Indeed, his practical criticism is largely used to illustrate his view that poetry is a criticism of life and that good poetry has high seriousness. Shakespeare has it, and so has Wordsworth, Keats, Seeley, Byron, Chaucer, and many others do not have it, and so are condemned accordingly. Fifthly, it is out of sympathy with the Augustan age, and so fails to appreciate the greatness of Dryden and Pope. They are mere classics of our prose, and their poetry does not have high seriousness or even poetic largeness, freedom, insight, benignity, etc. Sixthly, his basic lack of sympathy with the comic makes him value only tragic poems and look down upon comedy as contemporary trifles. This fact accounts for his meanly aphoristic emphasis that the trouble with Burns' poetry lies in a Scotch drink, a Scotch religion, and a Scotch manners. In short, poetry in his criticism does not remain poetry but becomes a sort of philosophy. Then the next heading, subheading, and point 8. A general estimate of Arnold as a critic, his limitations, his achievements and contribution. Opinion of critics. Matthew Arnold, the greatest of the Victorian critics, is a curious mixture of strength and weakness, of great merits and of demerits equally great. That is why he has been eulogized as well as condemned by critics equally competent. I repeat the line. That is why he has been eulogized as well as condemned by critics equally competent. In recent times, T.S. Eliot has spoken for all those who are not willing to accept him as a great critic. He calls him a propagandist, a salesman, a clever advertiser, rather than a great critic. He finds him lacking in the power of connected reasoning at any length, and that his flights are short flights or circular flights. F.R. Leavis, too, accuses him of high pamphleteering, pamphleteering. Even Professor Gorod, who is so sympathetic to Arnold, is of the view that he became a critic only by accident, the accident of Oxford professorship, and sneeringly says of him that the vendor of Frenchified disinterestedness was a hard-working school inspector with a national mission. But in the end, Professor Garrod himself is forced to conclude, if he is not the greatest of English critics, his makeup of being so is in itself a piece of greatness, and not to enjoy it is a piece of stupidity. Herbert Paul goes to the extent of saying that Arnold did not merely criticize books, he taught others to criticize books. Another critic praises him because his criticism is more compellingly alive, more thought-provoking than that of any other critic. Then the other subheading is his shortcomings. There is no denying the fact that as a critic of literature, Arnold has well-marked limitations and shortcomings, which may be listed as follows. First, he is incapable of connected reasoning at any length and often contradicts himself. Thus, first he lays down the test of total impression for judging the worth of a poet, soon after contradicts himself and prescribes the well-known touchstone method. According to Wimstedt and Brooks, this open appeal to the chunklet is a shift from his earlier position. Second, there is a certain want of logic and method in Arnold's criticism. He is not a scientific critic. Often, he is vague and fails to define or state clearly his views. Often, he is lopsided, as in his essay on Seeley, which is all biography except a brief concluding paragraph. His criticism is often gappy. Before he has fully established a point, he would hastily hurry on to the another. Then point 3. He frowns upon mere literary criticism. He mixes literary criticism with socio-ethical considerations and regards it as an instrument of culture. Purely literary criticism with him has no meaning and significance. Point 4. There is some truth in criticism that he was a propagandist and a salesman. As Wimstedt and Brooks point out, very simply, very characteristically, and very repetitiously, Arnold spent his career in hammering the thesis that poetry is a criticism of life. All his practical criticism is but an illustration of this view. Point 5. His criticism is lacking in originality. Practically, all of his critical concepts are borrowed. In his emphasis on action and high seriousness, he merely echoes Aristotle. His concept of grand style is exactly the same thing as the sublime of Longinus, and his biographical method is the method of the French Sainte-Beuve. As George Watson says, he plagiarizes too heavily. Then point 6. He might be learned, but his learning is neither exact nor precise. He does not collect his facts painstakingly. painstakingly. His illustrations of his touchstone method are all misquotations. Similarly, his biographical data are often inaccurate. Seventh point. He is in favor of biographical interpretation. He is also conscious of the importance of the moment, and yet he is against the historical method of criticism. Then point 8. He advocates disinterestedness, but ties the critic to certain socio-ethical interests. He would like him to rise above practical and personal interests, but he wants him to establish a current of great and noble ideas and thus promote culture. But disinterestedness means that the critic should have no interests except aesthetic appreciation. He speaks of the moral effects of poetry, of its high seriousness, but never of its pleasure, the aesthetic pleasure which a poem must impart and which is the true test of excellence. His standards of judgment are non-literary. Then point 10. His literary criticism is vitiated by his moral, classical, and continental prejudices. He is sympathetic only to classics. He rates the continental poets higher than the great English poets, and the moral test which he applies often makes him neglect the literary qualities of a poet. The moral in the life of a poet prejudices him against his poetry. The next subheading is his many merits, his achievements. Arnold's faults are great, but equally great are his merits and achievements. He is the most imposing figure in Victorian criticism. In his own day and for years afterwards, he was venerated and respected almost like Aristotle. After him, the cry for years was, "Arnold had said so." Says R.A. Scott James, "For half a century, Arnold's position in his country was comparable with that of a venerable Greek in respect of the wide influence he exercised, the mark he impressed upon criticism, and the blind faith with which he was trusted by his votaries." In certain respects, continues the learned critic, Arnold is superior to Aristotle. Aristotle knew none but the classics of Greek, the only literary models available to him, whilst Arnold, having the literatures of many nations and ages before him, was limited only of his own choice to the best that is known and thought in the world. Further, Arnold repudiated the idea that the critic should be an abstract lawgiver. Both of these considerations are important, but there is another fact which arrests our attention. In that body of Arnold's work dealing with critical principles which has most affected the public mind and has passed into currency as his distinctive doctrine, He is dealing with a function of criticism that did not concern Aristotle at all. Aristotle shows us the critic in relation to art. Arnold shows us the critic in relation to the public. Aristotle dissects a work of art. Arnold dissects a critic. The one gives us the principles which govern the making of a poem, the other the principles by which the best poems should be selected and made known. Aristotle's critic owes allegiance to the artist, but Arnold's critic has duty to society. He is a propagandist, tilling the soil so that the best ideas may prevail, making an intellectual situation of which a creative power can profitably avail itself. To prepare a social atmosphere which will stimulate the artist to make the best that has been written familiar to the public. This was the new task of criticism. It was to be a contribution to the problem of perfection or how to live. Arnold discussed and defined more clearly than any other writer before him the relation of the critic of literature to the society in which he lives. Herein lies his distinctive contribution to the study of critical principles. Arnold's criticism is of great historical significance. He provided the classical resistance, the counter-check quarrelsome to the prevalent but degenerate and decadent romantic criticism. In his reaffirmation of the classical norm of important, of the fable or action, of high seriousness, of the grand style, of the importance of study, of the ancients as models of excellence and perennial sources of inspiration, he did invaluable service to the cause of literature and literary criticism. As George Watson points out, he is the greatest gainsayer of criticism, the most insistent and professional of non-conformists. Criticism in the age was in a disorganized state. Arnold saved it from that disorganization by stressing the need of some system or principle in critical judgment, and he found such a system in the rules of the ancients. With this end in view, he stressed the need and value of comparative criticism. He raised criticism to a much higher level by waging a relentless battle against the intrusion of personal, literary, or religious prejudices. Then at last, we look at the conclusion. To conclude with the words of Saintsbury, his services, therefore, to English criticism, whether as a preceptist or as an actual craftsman, cannot possibly be overestimated. In the first respect, he was, if not the absolute reformer, the leader in reform of the slovenly and disorganized condition into which romantic criticism had fallen. In the second, the things which he had not, as well as those which he had, combined to give him a place among the very first. He had not the sublime and ever new inspired consistency of Dryden. He had not the robustness of Johnson, the supreme critical reason of Coleridge, scarcely the exquisite, if fitful, appreciation of Lamb, or the full-blooded and passionate appreciation of Hazlitt. But he had an exacter knowledge than Dryden's. The fitness of his judgment shows finer beside Johnson's bluntness He could not wool gather like Coleridge. His range was far wider than Lamb's. His scholarship and his delicacy alike were superior to those of Hazlitt. And friends, in this way we come to the end of this chapter, that is Victorian Criticism, Matthew Arnold.